Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio241, and it is March 4th. I've got the schedule on the right-hand side, and we're going to finish up enzymes and energy pretty fast today and then move into cell respiration, and we got a couple lectures this whole week on cell respiration. Then next week, a bunch of lectures on nervous system. That's probably a really long chapter, really important chapter. We'll have 3 lectures on that. And after that, that will be the material for the second test. And hopefully we will cover autonomic nervous system before the second test, but that's not going to be on the second exam. All right, so only chapters 4, 5, and 7 will be on the second exam, and that's on March 25th. So when is that? That's 3 weeks away from today. Okay? All right. So print out all of those study guides and just kind of understand what the scope of whatever it is that you have to do before that test so that you can kind of plan your time out a little bit so that you don't get cut short on time. But I think everybody did pretty well on that first exam as far as time is concerned. All right, so we were talking about some probably strange stuff for biology. It sounded more like physics, right, because we were talking about laws of thermodynamics last time. And how many laws of thermodynamics were there that we talked about? Yeah, there were 2. And the first one just says energy can't be created or destroyed. But what can you do with energy? According to that first law, you can change it from one form to another, right? From electrical to chemical or chemical to mechanical energy. And those things are what we call transducers. And then finally, we looked at this transducer over here, right? And it just so happens that it's green colored, and it can take energy in the sun and convert it into chemical energy, right? So it can take light energy and convert it into chemical energy, and that's why everybody is very envious of plants, right? Because they could just go to the beach, and they would be like making a milkshake all day long because they're in the sunlight. So for sure, I am very envious of them. This diagram also shows something about exothermic and endothermic reactions because here is the vertical axis is free energy, and as we go up, right, the axis, that means that the free energy increases. And so here we have CO2 and water, and these are located where? Really high on the graph or low on the graph? They're really low, so they're low in free energy. And this plant takes these molecules and it makes glucose out of it. Now, what can you tell me about glucose? Does it have more energy or less energy than CO2 and water combined? It has more, right? Because you just go up the vertical axis. Where did this plant get energy, right, to put into CO2 and water to make glucose? It has to have an energy source. And it got that energy from the sun, right? So sun energy. So the sun is providing this energy to go from a very random assortment of molecules to a more ordered assortment of molecules. And that doesn't just happen spontaneously, right? You don't have a building in pieces automatically just erect itself into a fancy building. It goes the other way. All right, so going from CO2 and water to glucose, that's what we call an endergonic reaction. Endergonic is when the products have more energy than the reactants. And if we were to go the other way, glucose breaking down into CO2 and water, that would be an exorganic reaction, and that would release energy instead of taking energy. Right? So an exorganic reaction means that the products have less energy than the reactants. That means you have some energy left over, hence exorganic. All right. Same thing for this diagram right here. Right? It's just a little bit different presentation of that previous slide going over exergonic and endergonic reactions. We have free energy on the vertical axis and then the progress through a metabolic pathway on the horizontal axis. And we have glucose and oxygen, right, being broken down into CO2 and water. So here we have the products with less energy compared to the reactants. So when product has less, is that endergonic or exergonic? Okay, it's exergonic if the products have less energy compared to the reactants, right? So this metabolic pathway is giving off energy. So this is what we call an exorganic reaction, right? So if you see anything going down with this energy scale, you know that's exorganic. And there are a couple different ways that Glucose can be broken down to CO2 and water in the presence of oxygen. It could go through all these little steps, and that's what we're going to look at in the next chapter coming up. Or it could just go with just one big step. Now, don't forget that a lot of reactions have an activation energy barrier to overcome. Right, so if I had a sugar cube or a glucose cube on the table right here, it wouldn't automatically convert into CO2 and water, even though it would like to do that. What would we have to do with that glucose to get it to turn into CO2 and water, to get it over that activation energy barrier? You'd have to light a match and put it underneath that glucose and put that extra energy of that match into that those chemical reactions, okay? And then that this exergonic reaction would release a lot of energy to sustain that reaction, right? It would start to burn as a result of that. Well, we don't have any furnaces in our body, right? So we don't break glucose down into carbon dioxide and water by burning it necessarily by using a flame to overcome the activation energy barrier. But what does our body have to overcome that energy of activation, that barrier? Enzymes, that's the whole point of an enzyme, right? It reduces the activation energy barrier so the reaction can happen very quickly. And so we have enzymes that control all of these different steps, but nonetheless, each one of these steps releases some energy. Right, so I see a nice exergonic reaction here, and most exergonic reactions in your body are used to make ATP. So this energy that's being released is going to go into making ATP, which is the energy molecule or energy currency inside of the cell. Right? So I see an exergonic reaction, and it's used to drive the formation of ATP from ADP and inorganic phosphate. And that is an endergonic reaction. Right? So exergonic reactions and endergonic reactions have to be coupled to each other. And that's what this slide here says. Again, we have a plot of free energy on the vertical scale, and then we have a couple metabolic reactions on the horizontal scale. So let's look at this big, kind of looks like a blue wheel to me, this big blue gear. We have reactants way up over here on the energy scale and products way down here on the energy scale. We see reactants go to products. Is this big wheel an exergonic or endergonic reaction? And how would you think of that? You might have to close that door if it's too noisy out there for you. If it's not, it's okay with me. All right, so let's get back to this one here. Okay, reactants going to products with this blue wheel, is that endergonic or exergonic? It's exergonic because the products have less energy than the reactants, and we could tell that by looking at this vertical scale. All right, so when this wheel turns, it can actually turn this wheel right here because they're coupled together. Now, what can you tell me about this smaller wheel? And who knows what color that is? I have no idea. Gray? Light blue. Tricky. Light blue. All right, now here we have reactants with less energy than the products, which means what? We have to put energy into these reactants to make products. And what kind of reaction is that when we actually have to add energy to something to make it work? That is an endergonic reaction. All right, so our body can couple these exergonic reactions with endergonic reactions to make ATP. All right, so that's an important consideration. So what the heck is ATP? I don't know if you've ever seen the nice molecular structure of ATP, but here it is right here. And it's a nucleotide with three phosphates. Here is what, an inorganic phosphate? So make sure when I say inorganic phosphate, you know that it's a phosphate with four oxygens. One is double bound. These others are hydroxide ions. So here is the first one, here's the second one, here's the third one. And notice, what do these little straight lines usually represent when we draw out a chemical formula like that? Okay, like I see one line here, I see one line here, I see one line here. What the heck are those things? Yeah, those are covalent bonds, right? Sharing of just two electrons. And then of course over here we have two covalent bonds. All right, now what about this squiggle thing? What the heck is that? That's a covalent bond, but it's a little bit different because it's much higher in energy compared to just the straight line. So how many high energy bonds are contained in ATP if we were to look at all these covalent bonds all over the place? I see one between the second phosphate group and the third, And I see one between the first and the second. So I see two high-energy phosphate bonds. And even this one out over here between the second and third, that's even a little bit higher than the one between the first and the second. All right, so when we have ADP, which are these two, and an inorganic phosphate, and when we join these together, it takes a little bit of extra energy to put into this bond. All right, so that's a high-energy endergonic reaction. Right, and that has to be coupled to a high-energy exergonic reaction to make that happen. But once it happens, then you have this energy stored in this chemical bond, okay, between the second and the third phosphorus. So here is the adenine nucleotide, and here are the three phosphates. Hence, we call that what? Adenosine triphosphate. So what are the building blocks of adenosine triphosphate on this slide? What are the building blocks for adenosine triphosphate? I see two things on this slide. You need adenosine diphosphate and you need inorganic phosphate, right? Those are the two molecules. Ooh, but there's something else that you need. And you should really think of it as a real physical entity. You can't really take a picture of it. You can't weigh how much it is. But what else do we have to add to this chemical reaction? We have to add ADP. We got to add inorganic phosphate. And we got to add something else to make this happen. Because this is an endergonic reaction, what do we have to add besides ADP and inorganic phosphate? And on your slide, you should probably draw it in. Draw an arrow going in. You need energy as well. Don't forget energy, right? So it's one of those things that you can't really see, can't touch, can't taste, smell, but it is there, right? And stored in these chemical bonds. All right, so this is ATP. I don't know if this is an exam figure or not. Can't remember. Might be. All right. One important class of chemical reactions that we're going to be looking at are what we call oxidation-reduction reactions. And these can be kind of difficult sometimes to appreciate, but what I want to impress upon you is just go back to the very basic, very easy definition of what these chemical reactions are, right? And that will help you understand what's going on. And here are the definitions, right? If a molecule gains electrons, we say that it is reduced. So maybe just write that out about 10 times or 100 times or whatever so that you're really familiar that when a molecule gets electrons from someplace, what happens to it? It becomes reduced. Right. And that also means that something else has to happen. If something is gaining electrons, that means that another molecule has to give them away. And that's the other end of this concept right here. And that is that a molecule, when it loses electrons, becomes oxidized. Right. So reduction and oxidation always have to go hand in hand. One molecule can't be reduced and nothing else oxidized because those electrons have to come from someplace. All right, so a reducing agent is an agent that can do what? It can reduce something else by giving electrons to it. So we call that an electron donor. An oxidizing agent accepts electrons. And when it accepts electrons from some other molecule, that other molecule loses electrons and therefore it becomes oxidized. Okay, so that's an oxidation reduction. These two reactions always have to go hand in hand. You can't have one with the other. All right, so reduction and oxidation are always coupled reactions. They involve, and you can cross this statement out, I would like for you to appreciate this oxidation reduction reaction as a transfer of electrons. Your book kind of makes a big point of hydrogens, but I think it's easier to understand if you just think in terms of electrons. Because here's your definition, right? When a molecule gains electrons, what do we call that? It is reduction, right? When a molecule loses electrons, that is what we call oxidation. All right, so I'm not so concerned with these hydrogens. So there are some coenzymes that play important roles because they carry high energy electrons, right? And these are NAD. And as a matter of fact, you should probably put a plus right here, NAD plus. It's actually an ion. And then FAD, we'll see what these things really are in just a second. And can you remember what a coenzyme is? Anybody go back and look what a refresher memory from the lecture last time or maybe the time before? We talked about coenzymes. What are they? Are they little or are they big? Okay. So we talked about two things at the same time. We talked about coenzymes and something else that was a cofactor. That's right. Which one is the tiny little metal ion? That's the cofactor. And a coenzyme is the big organic molecule. Right? And a cofactor is just something that maybe changes the active site to change the activity of an enzyme. But a coenzyme is important because it carries something from one chemical reaction to another. And so what NAD plus and FAD carry from one reaction to another are these high energy electrons. And they're big organic molecules. And sometimes these are vitamins. So what do these things look like? Right here. All right, so here is one of them. This is NAD+. Probably really hard for you to see on the screen, but you don't have to draw it out. Okay, here is FAD. You might recognize here is the adenine nucleotide, right, and then a ribose sugar, and then a phosphate. This almost looks like what? An adenosine monophosphate, adenosine diphosphate. Oh, but here's another nucleotide here, and that's how it got its name. Nicotine amide dinucleotide, because there's two nucleotides right here. You don't really have to know what NAD plus stands for, okay? But I think it's important for you to know why that plus is there. All right, why is that plus there? Because when we add electrons to it, what happens to that plus? Yeah, it gets neutralized, right? So this NAD plus form, I got to get this arrow back, sorry. It's driving me nuts. Arrow's visible. All right, so NAD plus is minus the electron, so this is the oxidized form of NAD. And when it accepts those electrons, it turns into something called NADH. NADH is carrying some high energy electrons from one set of biochemical reactions to another set of chemical reactions. And it's a big organic molecule, so this is a coenzyme. NAD or NADH, this is a coenzyme, two different forms, the oxidized state and the reduced state. Okay. Pretty much the same thing for FAD. And FAD, which we have right here, can accept some high energy electrons and also some protons. Right? And those high energy electrons then are carried from one set of chemical reactions to another. And FAD then can be reduced into FADH2. And FADH2 can be converted back to FAD if what kind of reaction happens? All right, so we say a reduction reaction happens when FAD goes to FADH. What's the reverse called? That's oxidation. That's right. So FADH2 can be oxidized back to FAD. All right, so these are some important oxidation reduction reactions, and I want you to at least become familiar with what some of these coenzymes look like. And you see you're kind of familiar with this because they kind of look like what? They kind of look like ATP, just arranged in a little bit different fashion. All right, so the bottom line is, what is NADH and FAD? What do they carry between biochemical pathways? That's probably what you should have in your mind. What are they carrying from one reaction to another, or one set of reactions to another set of reactions? The physical thing is those electrons. And those electrons have high energy, so really what these things are carrying is energy from one biochemical pathway to another in the form of high energy electrons. Okay, and it is true. Yes, you are in a biology class, even though we're talking about electrons. That's just the way it goes. We're very electrical beings. Okay, so that's it for this chapter. So what should you really be familiar with? This illustration right here. When the reactants have more energy than the products, what kind of reaction is that? That's an exergonic reaction. Okay? And exergonic reaction means that it has to release energy. So, and that energy in most of our biochemistry, this energy is used to make ATP. That's why we have exergonic reactions, at least the majority of them. All right, so before I close this PowerPoint presentation down, anybody have any questions? Okay, you're going to have to read that chapter a couple times, come up with some questions. And you know what? When you come up with questions, make sure you write them down. So you can ask me during office hours or in class, because this is probably so foreign to you, once you formulate a question maybe at 6 o'clock at night, you might not be able to remember that question at 7 o'clock in the morning. Okay, so make sure somehow you circle it or write it down so that you sure want to go back and fill in that information somehow that you're missing. Okay. All right, so let's end this and let's go on to the next chapter, which is 5, which is cell respiration. All right, and let me go put this on dual mode presentation right here. Cell respiration and metabolism. And here are my arrow options. Okay, a lot of times when we think of respiration, before we started to look at all this molecular stuff happening inside of your bodies, what do you think how did you think of respiration? How did you think? I think I heard breathing, right? Inhaling, exhaling as respiration. And cell respiration has to do with that, but it has to do why we breathe in and out. Okay? So we breathe in to get oxygen inside our bodies. That's going to be really important in this chapter. And we breathe out because we want to get rid of carbon dioxide. So sometimes we call that respiration, but what your body does with that oxygen and carbon dioxide at a molecular level, we call that cellular respiration. So it's just a little bit different thing. All right, so here are some things we're going to talk about, glycolysis, aerobic respiration, and fat metabolism. Probably won't get to protein metabolism. Okay. So here we see aerobic respiration. That means the kind of respiration that takes place when oxygen is present. Glycolysis, notice, it's not under aerobic respiration. We could put glycolysis under a concept called anaerobic respiration. What kind of respiration is anaerobic? If aerobic requires oxygen, anaerobic respiration does not require oxygen. Okay. All right, so let's start looking at some of these things. All right, so what do we mean by metabolism? Metabolism is just the sum of all the chemical reactions in your body. That's just metabolism. Some people like to think that these reactions have to involve energy transformations, and that's probably not a bad way to think of it. There are a number of chemical reactions in our body where the energy of the products equals the energy of the reactant, so there's really no energy change, but I think you maybe want to include those in metabolism anyway. So we can break all of the chemical reactions down in your body, which is metabolism, into two forms. One is catabolism and the other is anabolism. Catabolism breaks down molecules. It can take a large molecule and break it down into smaller ones, like glucose down into carbon dioxide and water. That's catabolism, right? And when you take glucose, break it down to carbon dioxide and water, can you remember if that's exergonic or endergonic? That's exergonic, right? So catabolism is exergonic reactions. It's another way of thinking about it. And since catabolism is exergonic, it releases energy. That energy can be used by your body, and those exergonic reactions provide the primary energy source for making ATP. And you need ATP in your body. Anabolism is just the opposite. Anabolism takes a large molecule, okay, or makes large molecules from smaller ones, right? So it takes small molecules and builds a big molecule out of it. But when you do that, you need energy. So anabolism is what we call an endergonic reaction. It requires energy. Right? And so this is a way that your body can store a lot of energy by taking small molecules, putting them together to make a big molecule, and in so doing, that energy is put into that big molecule, and you can store that big molecule in your body, which is a way of storing energy. Okay, so here is a really important slide, and I would like for you to look at this slide when we talk about pretty much everything in this chapter, and maybe even a lot of other things in this class. So here is a hugely important exam figure. Next week I'm going to have you draw this in lab as well. So it'd be really good if you understand what's going on here. All right, so I see some things like digestive tract. I see something like a liver right here. Sometimes that's part of the digestive system, but we're going to consider it to be something different. All right, so right here is the first row that has a digestive tract and the liver. These are two places that can donate glucose to our blood. That's why we have these two different places right here. The second line, maybe it looks red to you, this is your blood with inside of a blood vessel, right? Here's a nice endothelium. Here's a lumen of that blood vessel. So here is the second compartment we're going to be looking at, and that is plasma, or you could think of blood. And then here is the third line. This third line represents cytoplasm inside of a cell. So here is the blood inside the lumen of this blood vessel. And if something goes from here down into this third line, it means that it has entered a cell into the cytoplasm, right? It's gone through this endothelium. Oh, what kind of blood vessel allows for exchange? And I see the reason right here. It's a capillary. What can you tell me about the structure of a capillary? It's really thin. It only has endothelium, right? So it's a very small space for distance that the fusion has to take place, right? So here's a nice capillary. Maybe you should label that capillary. That's nice. Okay. And then here we have cytoplasm, this third row. And then this last row looks like a little bit different color. This is inside of a mitochondria. And you know what? As a matter of fact, the third row right here, I don't know if I really want to say cytoplasm. Maybe you should just say cytosol. Cytosol, right? The fluid part inside of a cell. Right, and then the fourth line will be inside the mitochondria. All right, so what are these spaces that we're going to be looking at? Well, spaces in the digestive tract, space within a blood vessel, space within inside of a cell, but not in an organelle like cytosol, and then this fourth space over here is inside of a mitochondria. So we're going to look and see what happens. All right, so that's how we're going to look at the different rows. Well, we have a couple of different columns as well. All right, the first column, we have the digestive tract. The second column, we have the liver. So why do we have two different columns? In either case, right, the digestive tract or the liver is going to be doing what with the blood? What's it going to be doing with the blood? It's going to be putting glucose into the blood. Right, so the liver has the ability to do that, and of course the digestive tract does because, well, we put food that we eat into our digestive tract. Right, and then part of that food contains glucose, and then that glucose enters our blood. So what would we want to call this state when we have eaten something and glucose goes from our alimentary canal into the blood? How would you want to think about this state? That's the fed state, F-E-D, fed state. Okay, that's used commonly. So this over here is the fed state. And where is glucose coming from when you're in the fed state? From the food that you eat. Right, so that helps maintain blood glucose levels. But do you eat all the time? Probably not when you're sleeping. Okay, and so remember that you have to have glucose concentration maintained within a range suitable to support life. So even though you don't absorb glucose from your digestive tract, there still should be something putting glucose into your blood when you're in this state over here. All right, so what's the opposite of being in a fed state? You're in a fed state or a fasted state, right? So maybe you put fasted over here. So when you're in a fasted state, this liver is very altruistic. It can take glycogen. Here it is, glycogen, break it down. What's the building block of glycogen once again? Glucose. It can break glycogen down into the building blocks and then can donate that glucose to the blood. It can secrete it into the blood, therefore maintaining homeostasis of blood glucose concentration in the blood. All right, so that's these two states, fed versus fasted. And that helps, and we just looked at a couple mechanisms where blood glucose concentration is maintained. Okay, so we've got glucose in the blood. Now, where does it go from there? Glucose is an important energy molecule. We've got to get it inside cells. All right, so it's going to go from the blood into the cytoplasm. And let's forget about how that's all controlled. Some of you might know a lot about that already. There's an important hormone that allows this process to happen. Glucose going from blood into the cytoplasm. Maybe just give you just a little foreshadowing of what we have to pay attention to. And that is insulin, right? Insulin is the passport that's necessary to allow glucose to enter cells. Without insulin, the cell right here won't be able to take up glucose and it's going to starve to death basically without insulin, okay? All right, so now we got glucose inside the cell, in the cytoplasm, or maybe let's just say cytosol is a better way of doing this. And we can take glucose and break it down into two pyruvate molecules. Can anybody remember how many carbons are in glucose? There are six? Yeah, there are just six. And this process that we call glycolysis, glyco stands for glucose. What does lysis mean? Splitting. So if we take glucose and split it exactly into two molecules, then you got 2 3 carbon molecules instead of 1 6 carbon. All right, so glucose going from one big to two small molecules, is that catabolism or anabolism? And is that endergonic or exergonic? It's exergonic, and we call that catabolism, right, by the definitions on the previous slide. All right, so glycolysis is a catabolic reaction that releases energy. And what did we say? What does your body like to do with exergonic reactions? It takes that energy and makes what out of it? ATP. Yep, ATP. Okay. All right, so we got pyruvic acid now in the cytoplasm, cytosol, and pyruvic acid or pyruvate. Pyruvate and pyruvic acid are exactly the same thing. It has two possible fates. You see that it has two possible fates? Well, there's one arrow going off to the right, and there's another arrow that proceeds downward. So that means pyruvic acid can undergo a couple different reactions depending on what's happening inside the cell. Okay, so if there is oxygen present, pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria. All right, so you might want to just draw like a little oxygen molecule someplace around here, because without oxygen, pyruvic acid cannot enter the mitochondria. It's stuck inside the cell. And we're going to see that causes some problems for the cell in just a little bit, probably on the next slide. All right, so the cell wants to get rid of pyruvic acid, so it can take pyruvic acid and oxidize it to lactic acid. Lactic acid can leave the cell. Pyruvic acid can't leave the cell, but lactic acid can leave the cell. And then that lactic acid actually goes back to the liver, and the liver with some energy can convert it back into glucose, and this process can happen over and over again. All right, these processes, glycolysis and this one step of converting pyruvic acid into lactic acid, does not require oxygen. So is this aerobic respiration or anaerobic respiration? Anaerobic respiration. And where is that taking place? In the cytosol, right? It's happening inside the cytosol, inside the cell. And let's just think maybe skeletal muscle, because a skeletal muscle is going to be contracting, it's going to be working, it's going to be using up ATP. All right, so that's one thing. All right, if there is oxygen present, that means pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria. And so we have a lot of nice carbon-carbon bonds in each pyruvic molecule, which contains energy. So the job of the mitochondria is to break all those covalent bonds apart in those carbon-carbon bonds. And remember, that's chemical energy. And what mitochondria do, takes that chemical energy in pyruvic acid and converts it into chemical energy to make ATP. All right, so how does it do that? Okay, here is this little arrow right here. It's pretty important. You might want to write in sort of next to that oxygen molecule that you have here. This is a preparatory reaction. All right, so preparatory reaction to what? Preparatory reaction to the Krebs cycle. All right, so now we're just getting an overview, and we're going to take a look in a little bit more detail what glycolysis is about and Krebs cycle and all that kind of stuff. Okay, the job of this Krebs cycle right here, well, this preparatory reaction will take a pyruvic acid. How many carbons are in pyruvic acid once again? There's 6 in glucose. We snip glucose in half. We get 2 pyruvates, so there's 3. There's 3 in pyruvic acid. And so when one pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria, this preparatory reaction snips off one carbon from pyruvic acid, and that one carbon becomes a carbon dioxide. What do you do with that carbon dioxide? You exhale it out of your body because it's an excretory product. Now you've got 2 carbons that enter the Krebs cycle, and the Krebs cycle breaks that 2 carbon fragment down into 2 more carbon dioxides, which you breathe out of your body, right? So the Krebs cycle produces CO2 that we have to expel from our body. We're going to look at some of the steps that do that. And the Krebs cycle is a cycle because these intermediates regenerate themselves under the right conditions. And when the cycle is turning, producing those 2 CO2s, it's producing some high energy electrons. Now, what are you going to do with high energy electrons? your body's really familiar with what to do with those high-energy electrons. You want to take it from the Krebs cycle to something we call the electron transport chain. So what do you know is something that can carry high-energy electrons from one set of chemical reactions to another? What kind of molecule does that? It's going to be a coenzyme in particular, okay, or generally speaking, it's a coenzyme, and you know the names of two specific coenzymes that can carry electrons from one set of chemical reactions to another, and that is NAD+ and FAD. Both can carry those high energy electrons. So we have NAD+ and FAD, right, carrying these high energy electrons to electron transport. Right. And then these electrons move from one molecule to another, to another, to another. They have high energy. They eventually end up at very low energy. So what do we call a reaction that starts at high energy, ends up at low energy? Is that exergonic or endergonic? Exergonic. Starts at high, goes to low. That's exergonic. And what does your body do with most exergonic reactions, like electron transport? Exergonic reactions are used to make ATP. All right, so electron transport makes ATP, right? We call that aerobic respiration because in order for these electrons to move through the electron transport chains, they have to end up in oxygen. And so if oxygen is necessary, we call this step aerobic respiration. Right. Okay, so here is just kind of the synopsis of what's happening in this fourth row right here. Carbon dioxide is produced because of the preparatory reaction and Krebs cycle. That oxygen, right, ends up in this water molecule over here with some of those high energy electrons. So the very last molecule that is made by aerobic respiration is water. What else could you tell me about water? Not only is it important for metabolism or cellular respiration, why else is water important in your body? It's the solvent, right? It's the solvent that all of your biochemistry is dissolved into. So water is, again, I want to point out, it's pretty special because not only is it the solvent that you're dissolved in, but it's also a very important metabolite inside your body. Okay? It participates in many chemical reactions. All right, so I do want you to be able to draw this out in lab. I want you to refer to this slide in a lot of the discussions that we're going to have in this chapter. And I'm going to say, what is the purpose of this slide right here? The purpose of this slide is not even on the slide, which is I find amazing. Okay, so don't say it out loud if you know what the purpose of all this stuff is. So I want, by next time or next week, I want you to tell me what the purpose of this slide is. Is the purpose of this metabolism to get rid of glucose? Is the purpose to break glucose down into pyruvic acid? Okay, is the purpose to make lactic acid? I see lactic acid being made right here. Is the purpose to make water? Well, you could probably say, no, not to make water because I can drink water anytime I want, right? Right? But is the purpose to make carbon dioxide? And again, you're thinking, no, because we get rid of carbon dioxide. All right, so what the heck is, and of course, the mitochondria need oxygen in order for this to happen, and we use up oxygen when this happens. So is the purpose of this slide right here to show us how to use up oxygen in our body? Is that the purpose of this slide? Okay. Well, I had you draw an oxygen, but I do want you to figure out what's going on here, some real important process that's not really on this slide. Okay. And next time I'll tell you what it is, we'll have a discussion. So try to figure out what is the purpose of everything that's happening here. Why do we have something called glycolysis? Why do we have electron transport? Okay, why do we have the Krebs cycle? Not on this diagram. And probably you should, the point of this whole chapter is to draw in what's missing from this slide. Okay. All right, so I'm going to go back to refer to this slide a bunch of times. So I think the first thing that we're going to look at probably is breaking glucose down into pyruvic acid, which is what? Glycolysis. Don't forget, glucose is six carbons. Snip it in half, you get pyruvic acid or pyruvate, and that's a lysis. Here is the overall reaction, okay, for glycolysis. It's a metabolic pathway, which means what? One step or many steps with intermediates. Since it's a pathway, It's many different steps with intermediates, metabolic intermediates between the first reactant and the final product. And the first reactant is glucose, and then the last product is pyruvic acid. But there's some other things that are important. Does not require oxygen. So is glycolysis aerobic or anaerobic respiration? Anaerobic respiration, okay. Here is the overall reaction. We got glucose, right? That's a reactant. We need some high-energy electron carriers, namely NAD. We need two of those. And we need some ADP, some inorganic phosphate. And when glycolysis happens, right, it's going to break glucose down into 2-pyruvate. But remember, that's exergonic. And so what can your body do with that exergonic or that energy? It can make ATP out of it. For glycolysis, how many ATP are made? There are 2, all right, but there are also, all right, maybe put a plus right here, NAD plus. There are 2 NAD pluses that are reduced into 2 NADH. Now, what does NADH have since it's reduced that NAD plus does not have? It has those electrons, and those are high-energy electrons. So remember that this NADH right here is the reduced form carrying high-energy electrons, and those high-energy electrons are going to be used in another part of cellular respiration. Right? So these are high-energy molecules. NAD are high-energy coenzymes. All right, let's see how this happens. All right, well, glycolysis is exergonic, produces a net 2 ATPs and 2 NADHs. Right? But to get this started, in order to start breaking glucose down into 2-pyruvate, there is an activation energy barrier. What does that mean? When you have to overcome an activation energy barrier, do you have to take energy out or do you have to put energy in? You've got to put energy in to get the reaction to take place. And that energy comes in the form of ATP. So even though it's producing 2 ATPs, it's going to take 2 to get everything started. And so this glucose has to be what we call phosphorylated, right? Some phosphates on ATP are going to be transferred to glucose, and then then glycolysis can proceed. What kind of enzyme do you know of that can phosphorylate something? I'll give you a choice. It can be a phosphatase or a kinase. What kind of enzyme is going to phosphorylate glucose? It's a kinase, right? Because it's going to phosphorylate something, okay? All right, and that phosphorylation, that inorganic phosphate, remember, it has a bunch of those oxygen atoms that were really hydroxyl groups, and the hydrogen came off and left a nice negative oxygen there. So that glucose now has a lot of negative charges on it. Do those negative charges move across the membrane easily, or is it impeded? Because remember, what can you tell me about ions? Okay, are they polar or nonpolar? What's the best way to think of them? They are polar, so they like to dissolve in water. If something likes to dissolve in water, can they get through a cell membrane? They're trapped, right? They can't get through the cell membrane. So one important thing about not only overcoming the activation energy barrier, glucose now has those inorganic phosphates on them, which then locks that glucose inside the cell, so glucose can't escape the cell. That's another important thing of that phosphorylation step, right? Phosphorylation traps glucose inside the cell, but you should kind of have a picture of why that happens. Because inorganic phosphate is a highly polar compound, and it just prevents glucose from going across the cell membrane. Okay, so here is a figure that you're kind of familiar with already. It's just a plot of free energy versus the progress of a biochemical reaction. It has a number of different steps. Here we have glucose, and then the first two steps require the utilization of ATP. Remember, ATP going to ADP is exorganic. Going from glucose to this first step is endorganic. These things are coupled together, so that increases the energy of glucose by phosphorylating it. And then it is the energy of glucose phosphate is increased once again at the expense of 1 ATP. All right, so now we have a glucose with 2 phosphates on it that required some energy from ATP. Now what can happen? Right? This reactant now can go all the way down to pyruvic acid. So here we have a high energy molecule. Down here we have a low energy molecule. So this second part of glycolysis, is this exergonic or endergonic? Going from high energy molecules to low energy molecules. It's exergonic. And let's see what can happen. Okay. NADH is high energy. NAD plus is low energy. So some of that exergonic energy is used to make NADH. But don't forget, what is that energy in the form of in NADH? High energy electrons, right? They're trapped in NADH. Here's another step, which is exergonic between 2 and 3. That energy that's being released now can take ADP and make 2 ATP out of it. Right? ADP to ATP is endergonic. That's being driven by this exergonic reaction. And then there's another important step between step 3 and 4 over here. That's an exergonic reaction. Right? You can see that on the graph. And what does your body like to do with exergonic reactions? Make ATP out of it. And we see that 2 more ATPs are made. So if we look overall at glycolysis, how many ATPs are used up? I see 1. I see 2 ATPs are used up. Now, how many are made? 2 are made here. 2 are made here. But in order to understand what the yield of this metabolic pathway is, we have to subtract the 2 that were used up to get things started. So what we call the net yield is what? Exactly 2 ATPs. Glycolysis can make 2 ATPs. All right, so you could think of that as like having $2 in your wallet. Are you really impressed that somebody has $2 in your wallet? Better than nothing, right? But I wouldn't call somebody rich. All right, but there's something else that's being produced, and that is 2 NADHs, right? And that can also, that has energy in it, that can be used to make ATP. We're going to see how that's done a little bit later. All right, so 2 NADHs, 2 ATPs are made by glycolysis because it's an exergonic reaction. Okay. All right, so that's pretty good. So can you relate this to that tree diagram that we're looking at, that plant diagram? Exergonic reaction being coupled to these endergonic reactions that make ATP. Okay, here's an exact figure. And here is glycolysis, how it really works. All right, so what's the input molecule to glycolysis? Indeed, it is glucose, and you see it has how many carbons? It's got 6, and it eventually goes all the way down to pyruvic acid. And how many carbons are in pyruvate or pyruvic acid? There are 3, so glycolysis makes what? 2 pyruvic acids, because there's no CO2 that's being produced anywhere in here. Okay, the first two steps require ATP, right? ATP is being used up. That gives glycolysis the proper activation energy to proceed all the way to the end. All right, and I'm not going to ask you to know the names of these molecules right here, so maybe it's not an exam figure. I don't know, sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. Is it this year? It's not? Oh. Are you disappointed? You're okay with that? Okay. Well, anyway, I still want you to know some details, even though you don't have to draw it out exactly. All right, so this first step right here, does it produce ATP or utilize ATP? It uses up ATP. Okay. So now you've got 2 phosphates on a sugar, which has 6 carbons, and it was converted into a fructose. And now this fructose is split into 3 carbon molecules. And the next step after that is that an NAD plus then becomes converted into NADH. All right, so what kind of step is that? NAD plus to NADH. Is that a reduction or an oxidation of NAD? NAD plus becomes reduced, right, to make NADH. All right, what's in NADH? Because it's reduced, it has gained some electrons. What can you tell me about those electrons? High energy, right? High energy electrons. Okay, the next step, we see that ADP plus inorganic phosphate are combined to make ATP. That's something that's really, really nice. A couple more steps over here. And then this last step, again, another ATP is used with inorganic phosphate to make an ATP. But now this column over here happens how many times for every glucose? 2. Yeah, there's one on the left, there's one on the right. Right, so there's not really 2 ATP that's made, there are 4. And there are 2 NADHs that are produced. But don't forget, these 2 here at the beginning have to subtract from the 2 ATPs that are made over here. Hence, the end reaction is what? 2 ATPs and two NADHs, and what? Two pyruvic acids. That's the overall reaction. All right, something else that's on this diagram that is really nice to see. Look at this step between glucose and glucose-6-phosphate. Okay, here we have a kinase that's phosphorylating glucose to make glucose-6-phosphate, but what else do you see? I see another arrow going the opposite way. All right, so what can you tell me about glycolysis? Not only can it progress in the forward direction from glucose to pyruvate, what else can happen? It can go in the reverse direction. Okay? It can go from pyruvate and make some new glucose. Okay? And what reaction would you like to really have running in your body? Probably the forward reaction to make ATP. Right? But nonetheless, the reverse reaction is very possible to happen. All right, so why is that important? Because that tells us something about the fate of pyruvic acid. Remember on that one of the first slides, we saw that pyruvic acid has two possible fates. What were the two possible fates? Let's go back. What are the two possible fates? Enter the mitochondria if what is present? Oxygen. Or the second fate is to become lactic acid when no oxygen is present. Okay? All right, so why do we have this anaerobic respiration? Why do we have pyruvate being converted into lactic acid? Well, pyruvate can't leave the cell. It just can't leave. So when glycolysis is happening, pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell. And when it builds up inside the cell, guess what? Because of Le Chatelier's principle, what's it going to do to glycolysis? It's going to try and make it work in the reverse direction. We call that the law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. All right, and when glycolysis goes in the reverse direction, it can't make ATP. All right, and of course we need ATP to stay alive. Also, when glycolysis is going in the forward direction, it's using up NAD plus and making what? It's making NADH, right? In order for glycolysis to go in the forward direction, it has to have NAD plus. And when pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell, all the NAD plus is now converted into NADH, and if NAD plus is not available, then glycolysis can't happen in the forward direction, which means that it can't make ATP. How important is it for your body to make ATP? How much ATP do you need? Have we talked about that already in class? I think we have. Why is ATP really important? Did we talk about your brain? I forgot if we talked about this, right? So if we cut off blood supply to your brain, no oxygen is going to the brain, and your brain cannot make ATP, which is the energy source. How long do you have consciousness after blood supply to the brain is cut off? How long can you stay conscious when you can't make new ATP? It gets used up. Yeah, 2 or 3 seconds, right? All right, so that's how much ATP. And then, if you don't restore blood supply to the brain, when does your brain actually die? Again, 2 to 3 minutes. It's a little bit more than seconds, but 2 to 3 seconds, you pass out, 2 to 3 minutes, the brain is dead. And of course, when the brain is dead, what does that mean? You can't get it back to life, right? That's an irreversible process. All right, so that kind of illustrates how important ATP is and how much you have to make all the time, right? You only have about 2 seconds worth of ATP in your brain if it can't be regenerated. Here's one process. Another way to think of how important ATP is let's just consider how much a regular person weighs. A regular person weighs about 70 kilograms. That's maybe 160 pounds, something like that. Not anybody in here weighs 160 pounds, but let's just say on average maybe 160 pounds. And in terms of ATP, how much ATP do you need in your body relative to your weight? Okay, you need 40 kilograms of ATP every day to stay alive, which is what? That's more than half your body weight. You don't have to have a suitcase and carry it around with you with all that ATP, because that your body can regenerate that ATP by, here's one process, glycolysis, right? So glycolysis and other reactions have to make 40 kilograms of ATP in your body every day just for you to stay alive. All right, so that tells you something really important right here. So glycolysis really should not go in the reverse direction. But when pyruvic acid builds up, it's going to want to do that. Fortunately, there's a reaction that takes care of that. Pyruvic acid cannot leave the cell, but It can be reduced into lactic acid by what we call the lactate dehydrogenase reaction. All right, so what does that do? That takes pyruvic acid, NADH. Remember, NADH is the reduced form of NAD. And the electrons in NADH then are donated to pyruvic acid, converting it to lactic acid. And has there been a decarboxylation? Has pyruvic acid lost the carbon atom? No, I still see three. Lactic acid has three. Pyruvic acid has three. The only thing that happens is that pyruvic acid has been reduced to this form, and lactic acid now can leave the cell. So this reaction right here uses up pyruvic acid. It takes pyruvic acid away from this situation. All right. So when pyruvic acid disappears, what happens to glycolysis? It gets stimulated in the forward direction to replace that pyruvic acid that has been lost. That's Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. Remember, pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell. It's going to force glycolysis to go in the reverse direction. Right. The other thing that this reaction does, right, is that it uses up NADH and it produces NAD+. And in this previous slide, what do you need NAD+ for? These steps in glycolysis. Without NAD+, glycolysis can't go in the forward direction. So this lactate dehydrogenase reaction does a couple things. Gets rid of pyruvic acid, but it also regenerates NAD+ so that glycolysis can proceed in the forward direction. And when glycolysis goes in the forward directions, what's happening? What's the good thing that's happening? What's being produced? ATP. Yeah, ATP. And that ATP, of course, is necessary to keep our cells alive. Brain was just one example. Okay. So, probably you should write on this slide right here, okay, reduced and oxidized. So pyruvic acid, is this the oxidized form or the reduced form of pyruvic and lactate in this particular reaction? Yeah, pyruvic acid is oxidized. Lactic acid accepts some electrons. So this is the reduced form. So pyruvic acid oxidized go to reduced form. What can you tell me about that reduction reaction? It always has to be coupled with an oxidation reaction. Right? And look what we have right here. We have NADH, which is the reduced form. It goes to NADH, or NAD+, which is the oxidized form. Right? So here are two. Well, here's an oxidation-reduction reaction. Right? One going one way, the other going the other way. Okay, so this process, do you see oxygen being used up in this reaction at all? No. So is this aerobic or anaerobic respiration? Anaerobic respiration, right? And we call this fermentation. Other animals do this, or other organisms do this in a little bit different way. Some actually decarboxylate that produces a CO2. You might be working with some yeast in lab that actually do this, right? It's an anaerobic reaction. Doesn't require oxygen. We call that fermentation. What happens? Maybe I could, marker. Let's write this down on the board. This is kind of fun. What do we got? Pyruvic acid. Right here, three carbons. And instead of lactate dehydrogenase, yeast have something called alcohol dehydrogenase. All right, so what a yeast does is that it takes this pyruvic acid and makes this thing a two-carbon plus then a CO2. What is CO2? Is that a solid or a gas? That's a gas. Okay, and what else? We have NADH right here going to NAD+. All right, so here is the oxidized, here's the reduced. So here's oxidized going to this reduced form. And so these are just hydrogens, some hydrogens, and here is an OH. All right, so who recognizes this molecule right here? Anybody recognize this one? It's got two carbons, and this OH, it's an alcohol. This is what we call ethyl alcohol, which is what in our bodies? This is the reason why we don't have alcohol dehydrogenase. Because ethyl alcohol is toxic. is very toxic to us. It's toxic to our nervous system. Anything that has a nervous system is depressed with this molecule right here. Yeast doesn't have a nervous system, so they don't get inhibited by this one. So what can you recognize? What's happening right here? When have you used this particular reaction? Maybe today you've used this. Because you would use yeast to make bread, right? Because you have that glucose, and with this alcohol dehydrogenase, you mix it in with some flour that produces this alcohol, which kind of evaporates, but it also produces that CO2. And what does that CO2 do to bread? It makes it rise up, okay? And if you ever live near a bakery, probably you smell all that alcohol that's coming off of it, okay? So that's one reason, or one application. What's another application? You can take sugar. Under certain conditions, you can make ethyl alcohol. And what's ethyl alcohol? That's just adult beverage, right? And you consume that, and that is toxic to your brain, and that puts you in a different altered state of mind, right? And if you keep the CO2 in there, what do you have? You have beer or you have champagne. If you let the CO2 move out of solution, what do you have? Well, then you have something like wine. Okay, so yeast do that kind of thing. That's what we call an alcohol fermentation. Okay, so our bodies can't do that because alcohol is toxic. And under what conditions does pyruvic acid get converted into lactic acid in our bodies? Aerobic or anaerobic? Anaerobic conditions, right? That's because we have LDH, but if we had alcohol dehydrogenase, right, we could get drunk just by holding our breath. All right, so that would not be very beneficial. Okay, so we don't do that in our bodies, but other organisms that don't have a nervous system can get away with that. All right, so that's the lactic acid pathway, and I think I talked about all of this already. Okay. All right, so where is that on this diagram? Click here. Here's that lactic acid pathway. It gets rid of pyruvate, so glycolysis can operate in the forward direction, but it also, remember, regenerates NAD+, because NAD+ is an important reactant for glycolysis. Right? So that has to be built back up. All right, so where does that take us? That takes us to, well, what happens if there is oxygen present inside the cell? All right, if there is oxygen present inside the cell, going back to this slide right here, then pyruvic acid can enter into the mitochondria. And we're going to get to that in just a second. All right, so we have some important reactions that are taking place right here. What do we call glucose being broken down into pyruvic acid? That's glycolysis, right? So this arrow here is glycolysis. We said, because of that one complicated diagram, if pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell, the reverse can happen. And I do want you to know what that reverse what the reverse metabolic reaction is called. Metabolic pathway. What's a reverse metabolic pathway called? It's making glucose. We call that gluconeogenesis. Right, so glycolysis is going one way, going the other way is gluconeogenesis, making glucose from pyruvic acid. Right, so probably some of you know that people have trouble regulating blood glucose concentration. They're diabetics. One reason might be because they have too much glucose in their diet. What's another reason? Maybe their cells are making too much glucose because of gluconeogenesis. And if we can inhibit that pathway, then we can help resolve that diabetic condition for our patients. Right? So that's pretty handy. And so that's one of the reasons why we're looking at all of this stuff right here. Okay. So gluconeogenesis is pyruvate going to glucose. Here are another couple reactions. Your body does not like to store glucose as a single molecule, because that increases the osmolality of a solution. And when something has a high osmolality, it attracts water. And what happens to a cell when it attracts water, because it's very salty, or maybe it has a lot of sugar inside of it? It starts to swell up, right? And it might actually burst. So your cell can't keep a lot of glucose. So what it does is that it binds glucose together, makes a big polymer. And we call that glycogen. So glycogen is one molecule. It doesn't change the osmotic properties of the cell. The cell doesn't swell up and burst, but it still has all of those glucose molecules in a nice storage form. Okay, so glycogenesis is the process of taking glucose and making glycogen out of it, right? Genesis is the producing, the making of something. And it's the making of glycogen. Glycogenolysis, I see lysis right here. What does that mean? It's splitting apart. It's a splitting apart of glycogen. This is the reverse process. All right, so glycogenesis is making glycogen from glucose. Glycogenolysis is making glucose from glycogen. It goes the other way around. All right, so now we learned four of these things. All right, we got glycolysis, which is breaking down glucose. We've got gluconeogenesis, making glucose from pyruvate. That's the reverse of glycolysis. When you have glucose, you can make glycogen out of it. That is glycogenesis. And when you are running low on glucose, right, your body can take glycogen and break it down to glucose, which is the opposite of glycogenesis. We call that glycogenolysis. All right, so I think you're going to have to, like, trap one of your kids or your brother and sister and pronounce these terms so that you can really see that they're different words, right, have different meanings. And if you can't see right now in the slide that the spelling of glycogenesis is different than glycogenolysis, then you need to get some reading glasses. Okay, so that you can really see that there is a difference. It's really hugely important that you can appreciate the difference between these different words because conceptually they're doing different things in our body. Was there a question? Did I hear a question? No. Okay. Yeah. Okay. What's glycogenesis? Making of glycogen. From, what's the building block of glycogen? Oh, that was on the first, that was on the first test, that's glucose. Okay, and so there are cells that can take glucose and make glycogen out of it via a process called glycogenesis. When you're in a fasted state and blood glucose starts to decrease, you don't have to be too concerned because you have glycogen in your body. So, in particular your liver can go to that glycogen and break it down. And what's the building block of glycogen once again? Glucose. And when your body breaks glycogen down to glucose, that enters your blood, that maintains your blood glucose levels, that process is called, since we're breaking something down, that's lysis. It's not the breaking down of glucose, it's the breaking down of glycogen. So that's glycogenolysis. And I'm sure you're going to have to say these words out loud before you become familiar with them, because they're kind of a tongue twister. But once you can say them out loud, you'll be able to think of them too. All right, so what kind of organs can store glucose in the form of glycogen? Skeletal muscle can, and the liver can. Those are the two main areas. Okay. All right, so here are some pathways that you should be familiar with. And you're familiar with glycolysis. What's glycolysis once again? Well, you start with glucose and you break it down into two pyruvate molecules. Glycogenesis. Genesis means the building of something. It's the building of what? Glycogen, right? And what building blocks would you need to make glycogen? Glucose, right? So that's what this says right here. That happens mostly in skeletal muscle and the liver. Glycogenesis is the producing of or the synthesis of glycogen from glucose. And then glycogenolysis, okay? Glycogenolysis is the reverse of what? Glycogenesis or glycolysis? Yeah, glycogenolysis is the reverse of glycogenesis. And then here's one that I mentioned, but here's the first time you see it spelled. Gluconeogenesis is what? Genesis is the production of glucose, but it's new glucose that comes from pyruvate, those two, three carbons. Can you picture how glucose can be made from pyruvate? Because how many carbons are in glucose? There's six. And how can you get six? Because you can take a pyruvate that has three, another pyruvate that has three, and what? Join them together to make a glucose. Okay. That is the reverse of glycolysis. Okay. Let's look at lipogenesis. Okay, what kind of compound are we talking about here? A nucleotide, a protein, a carbohydrate, or what? Lipogenesis. Yeah, fat, like a lipid. And genesis means what? The building of lipids, right? And the building of lipids happens in adipose tissue. We're going to take a look at that in this chapter a little bit. And lipolysis is what? The same thing as lipogenesis? No, it's the reverse, right? It's the splitting of lipids. It's the breakdown of triglycerides. And you know what a triglyceride can be broken down into? Anybody remember what a triglyceride is broken down into? A glycerol and three fatty acids. With what kind of reaction? It says right there. Hydrolysis reaction, right? Okay. And ketogenesis we might get into. All right, so you're going to have to become familiar with these terms. Some of them are pretty easy to understand. Others of these are a little bit of tongue twisters, but you'll have to remember how they work. Okay, so here is a really good slide on glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. So what do we have on this slide right here? We got glucose in the blood over here. We got glucose in the blood over here. And then this just represents a cell. It could be a liver cell or a muscle cell. And let's just say we have high glucose in the blood. So when glucose is high in the blood, it's going to go into this particular cell. Of course, insulin has to be present. And then the first step is glucose is phosphorylated, right? And that phosphorus group is highly polar. So now that glucose, this glucose 6-phosphate, can't leave the cell. It's trapped inside the cell. And what is that? That's a glucokinase. Right, that's an enzyme, kinase phosphorylates something. So now we got glucose phosphate inside the cell. That glucose can be broken down to pyruvate via glycolysis. Or if there's plenty of energy inside the cell, this glucose can be added to glycogen. It's going to be dephosphorylated when that happens. So now you got glucose and glycogen. All right, when the cell starts to, or when your body starts to run low on glucose, all right, so glycolysis won't happen because you're running low on glucose, but how can you maintain blood glucose? You've got glycogen here. You can break it down, glycogen to glucose 1-phosphate. Oh, what do we call something that adds a phosphate to glucose? That's another kinase enzyme. Over here is a phosphatase enzyme. And, you might be seeing something right now. What's the relationship between 1 and 2? They're antagonistic to each other, right? So you're familiar with musculoskeletal systems that are antagonistic to each other, nervous system like parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. Now here is a nice metabolic reaction that shows antagonism. And what's the good thing about that antagonism? Precise control and balance of blood glucose levels, right? Here's just one mechanism. All right, so glycogen is broken down to glucose 6-phosphate. Now, here's something special. Does not happen in muscle, but it does happen in the liver. Muscle does not have a glucose 6-phosphatase. A phosphatase takes that phosphate off, right? And so muscle has always got glucose 6-phosphate, which means this glucose can never leave the cell. Muscle cells don't like to share glucose with any other cell in your body. But the liver has that phosphatase enzyme. It can dephosphorylate glucose. And now that glucose can leave liver cells in particular and enter the blood. All right, so what kind of state would you be in when your liver glucose 6-phosphatase is taking phosphate off of this glucose 6-phosphate so that glucose can enter the blood? What state are you going to be in? What are two states that you could be in? What are the two? You're either in the fed state or fasted state. All right, so when does this enzyme become activated? When you're in the fasted state, right? Because now your liver is very altruistic. It will give up glucose so that the rest of your body doesn't go without glucose. All right, so try to name this enzyme right here, number one. Name this enzyme over here as well. One's a phosphatase, one's a kinase. And maybe name this one right here. This is a phosphatase. And what would be one over here? If this is a phosphatase, here is a kinase over on this side of the cell. Okay, so that's glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. Those are two important pathways for something that we call the Cori cycle. Right? And on the Cori cycle, we see that there is a muscle cell on the left-hand side, and there is a liver cell on the right-hand side, and there's a connective tissue that connects these two cells together, or these two tissues together. What is that connective tissue? That's blood. Yeah, blood is one of those weird connective tissues, right? It can connect organs in radically different areas of your body. Okay? And so here we have blood. All right, well, I got an important meeting coming up, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, and I would like for you to actually name some of these metabolic pathways before the next lecture. Like, what is glucose-6-phosphate going to pyruvic acid? Number two is glycolysis. Okay, what is pyruvic acid going to lactate? That's just the LDH reaction. All right, so make sure you can label this slide, and we're going to talk about this slide when we come back on Thursday. And this is a hugely important exam figure. Okay, so we want to be able to label all these things. Some of these numbers aren't in your textbook, though. So we got to go over it in lecture. Okay, and then we get to talk about aerobic respiration after that. Okay, who's got that sign-in sheet?